talk about the subprime mortgage problem and crisis. I plan on talking for about 15 minutes. Kit's going to talk for about 15 minutes. At the end of that, the hour will be up. Kit teaches at Concordia College in New York and in the business school. I'm an economist at the University of Maryland. Most of you have heard that, but not all of that. You may come in today. We want to talk about, Kit just said, value and perception of value. That is kind of what's going on initially with the mortgage market. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And then what's going on with the financial markets in larger terms. And this can be really complicated or very simple. We'll try to make it simple, but we'll try simple, and we'll see. People have lots of ideas about money and financial markets, and so it might be complicated. A mortgage, you borrow money on your house and you get a mortgage, okay? When you borrow money, you're selling a bond. And you're selling a promise to pay. Your mortgage is an IOU, right? So we need to think about how bonds, the value of bonds is determined. And since most of us don't buy, when we read the financial market pages, we don't buy and sell bonds. Often it looks weird because they're buying and selling loans. And the terms that they use are a little bit confusing. If you go to the bank and the interest rate is 5%, okay, and you want to get an income $5, how much do you have to put in the bank?
$100,
right? So if you put $100 in the bank at 5% interest, it'll provide you with a stream of income $5 forever, essentially. Okay, we're going to play the forever game rather than worrying about different stuff. If the interest rate is at 10% and you want a $5 stream of income, how much do you have to put in the bank?
$50.
So now let's say that you've invested in a treasury bill, you have a savings bond, those little things, that pays you $5 a year for the rest of your life. Okay? In fact, the British used to have things called councils, which were for life. And the interest rate is 5%. How much is it going to cost you to buy that?
Pounds.
No, it's right up here.
$100,
right? If you want to get a bond that will pay you $5 a year for the rest of your life and the interest rate is 5%, that will cost you $100 to buy in the market. Okay? Because you can just do it at the bank. All those prices are going to equilibrate. If you own the bond and you're getting your $5 a year check from the government and the interest rate goes from 5% to 10%, how much can you now sell the bond for?
$50.
Right? Even though you bought it for $100, what you bought was the right to $5 a year, okay? And you got, and you need to think about this as being the, what I call the bond value or the bond price. And we typically think, how much money do I have to put in the bank to get the income stream? But given that there's an income stream that's been promised, what's it worth? When you buy a house for $100,000, or you get a mortgage on your house for $100,000, and the interest rate is 5%, you have to pay $5,000 a year in mortgage payments. Well, and we'll just think about the interest here, not the principal. That just makes it more complicated. It doesn't make it any more insightful. So that mortgage is worth $100,000. And you might, my mortgage is held by Bank of America, but Bank of America actually, I got with Bank of America because I borrowed money from a small local bank in Maryland called Silver Spring. And they turned around and sold it to Bank of America. If Bank of America wanted to sell my mortgage, that was a 5% mortgage on which I paid $5,000 a year, so it was worth $100,000, and the interest rate suddenly went to 10%, how much could Bank of America sell my mortgage to somebody else for?
$50,000.
Now, my mortgage payments hadn't changed, but the value of the bond on the market had gone down when the interest rate went up. Now, I want to make sure everybody's on the page with this, because we don't get this part, we won't be able to understand what's going on. Okay, that when interest rates fluctuate, the value of bonds move in opposite directions. When interest rates go up, the value of bonds go down, because bonds are the, what the economists say, the capitalized value of an income stream.
Give a simplified version in a bargaining economy.
There is none.
There isn't.
Okay, you go. You sell a kid a tree and he promises to pay you apples, right? And so you have a stream of apples. What's the stream of apples worth to somebody else?
Right.
But you need to monetize this.
Oh, okay.
You can do the math in apples, but we're just be back to 500 apples.
Okay.
It wouldn't matter. Okay? It's a whole lot easier to think of it this way.
Well, but I guess part of the answer to that might be is if you have all of a sudden a glut of oranges and bananas and everything else coming in, all of a sudden the apples aren't worth as much, right? That's the reason.
Yeah, but that's way too complicated. Yeah. It's not that complicated. Just think about how much money you have to put in the bank to get this income stream, and then think about it the reverse way. What's this income stream worth in terms of how much money you have in the bank? When interest rates go up, your $5 a year is worth less. Now, see, this is complicated in some ways, because you think, oh, the interest rate goes to 10%, and I have $100 in the bank, I should get $10. And in fact, that is what would happen, right? The problem is that when borrowers and lenders, they're selling loans. When you buy and sell loans, you're not selling the value, you're selling the income stream, right? So when you sell a loan to Bank of America, you promise to pay your interest payments every month for the next 30 years or 360 months. And that's what they're buying and selling, right? Is your mortgage payment, okay? So in 1938, Federal National Mortgage Association, roughly, FNMA, or its initials on the stock exchange, the Fannie Mae, was created by the national government to provide a secondary market in mortgages. What does the secondary market mean? It means that a bank or a savings and loan would originate a mortgage, which would have terms which required the borrower to pay over some term, and then that mortgage had a face value, which was the amount it was actually taken out for, and it had a market value, which would depend on the interest rates. And Fannie Mae actually would buy those mortgages from the originating banks. This was during the 1930s. They were trying to get the housing market started. And so what the government was willing to do was essentially lend money to banks to lend money to people who had mortgages. But that's not how it's said in financial markets. Fannie Mae bought bonds. When you buy a bond, you're making a loan, right? You're loaning this money to get that income stream. So Fannie Mae and then later Freddie Mac was established in the late 1960s, provided a market for bonds, for mortgages, in which they have forms. Now they're the HUD forms. Have you ever gotten a mortgage? You know, there's a standardized form. And Fannie Mae basically set up a set of standards of the borrowers and the house criteria, you know, how much income they made relative to the value of the house, what was the equity in the house, and all that sort of stuff. Required inspections and all the paperwork. And if a bank made a qualifying loan, a conforming loan is what it's typically called, then Fannie Mae would buy it. Then Fannie Mae would take and make bundles. It wasn't always 1,000 mortgages, but let's call it 1,000 mortgages. They would bundle together 1,000 mortgages and sell them. Now, if there was 1,000 mortgages of $100,000 a piece, that would be $10 million, right? I don't know, I have trouble with zeros. So what you can do is you can invest in 1,000 mortgages at once by lending money to Fannie Mae, by buying the bundles of mortgages. Okay, in today's market, these would be called prime mortgages. And these are securitized mortgages. Because now what you've got is a bundle of mortgages, the income stream from which is all 1,000 of them. So if you own the bundle, you get the monthly payments. And Fannie Mae would actually provide you firm security and guarantee for that. So the idea here was to make it easier for banks and savings and loans to lend people money to buy houses, because if they could loan to you at 6% and sell to Fannie Mae at 5.9%, right, they could borrow at 5.9 and lend at 6. But actually, because when the interest rate goes down, the value goes up. They could they could lend you the money, turn around and sell to you the mortgage. They would buy your mortgage and sell your mortgage. That's the reverse of borrowing and lending, and make a profit on it. That was a way for the government to pump liquidity into the mortgage market, and that's been going on. Now, what happened in the 1980s was banks, anybody ever had a jumbo loan? Yep. Fannie Mae has a cap on how much it'll lend, the mortgage amount to buy. So a jumbo loan, I think, is now roughly $420,000. And if you're in a jumbo loan, you're not conforming. So you might be a really good credit risk, and you might fill out all the Fannie Mae forms, and Fannie Mae loves you as far as being a credit risk, but you're non-conforming because you're too big. Or you might not have a job, okay, and you're getting a mortgage. So what happened was other investment banks, and largely Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan, and stuff, got involved in non-conforming or subprime. Subprime does not necessarily mean bad. It means not Fannie Mae. Okay? So the problem with this then got to be, this is actually really, really good. In Mexico, I have a good friend at Stanford who works on Mexico, and in Mexico, the courts will not evict, or they will not foreclose on people who have mortgages. They won't evict them. And as a result, how many people get mortgages? Very, very few. Everybody. Look, you can't, there's two sides in every deal, right? Why would you lend money to somebody on the security of your house if you couldn't use their house as security? Because if they didn't pay, the courts wouldn't evict them. So what this does is provide a mortgage, a really clearly defined mortgage loan, and a secondary market in which you provide lots of liquidity, and it's really easy for people to buy houses. Is that good?
Usually.
Yes!
Yes. Usually.
No, it's almost always good. How many of you have a mortgage or have had a mortgage in your life? Would you all like to have paid 2% more?
No.
Would any of you prefer to have paid 2% more on your mortgage?
No.
Thank this system. Okay? Do not sneeze at the benefits of this. Right? Because it saved you a bundle of money. Now, in the subprime crisis, what happened is they started... they were making subprime could be really, really good loans or poorer quality loans. And in the run-up in housing crisis of the 1990s, it was easier for people to make bad loans. And actually, what they really, not necessarily bad loans, but they reduced the equity that the lender had to put up. So instead of being 80%, which is the typical Fannie Mae, they'd go to 90% or 95% or 100%. They'd lend you the whole purchase price of the house. And what that meant is that if they lent you $100,000 to buy a house that was worth $100,000, when the house went to $90,000, you were better off walking away from your loan, right? Rather than incurring an obligation of $100,000, give the bank the house, which was only worth $90,000. Part of the foreclosure problem is related to that. What happened, and this is where they're just about to transfer to Kit, is that last year, in the beginning of the year, for a variety of reasons, both because housing prices started to fall, people started worrying about an increase in foreclosure rates. It turns out foreclosure rates have been going up steadily since the beginning of the 1970s. That is the rate, and it's really low. I mean, it's like less than 1% of all loans. At the moment, about 2% of all loans are in 90 days late on their payment. And a bunch of those, that does not mean that 2% of every homeowner is about to lose their home, because a lot of people don't have mortgages and all that kind of stuff. So we're talking about small numbers. They look like they're big relative to one another, because when you go from 1 to 2%, they say, foreclosure rates increased by 100%. You think, wow, everybody's lost their house. Lies, damn lies, and
statistics.
Okay. So what happened then was that people started worrying about the quality of the loans in the bundles. But these bundles are a pig and a poke. There's no way to see what the pig looks like. There's no way to open up the bundle and see what kind of loans you got. If you buy from Fannie Mae, you know that the loans meet these minimal standards. When people started losing confidence, lenders demanded higher interest rates. They demanded more risk premium. And when interest rates went up, what happened to the value of the bundled mortgages, the securitized mortgages? They went down, and in fact, they go down really, really fast. Small changes in interest rates have big impacts on capitalized values. Even if the income stream is not affected, even if nobody defaulted on one of their mortgages, zero, everybody in the country was on time with their mortgage payments, the rise in the interest rates would cause the value of the securitized mortgage bundles to fall. Value versus perception of value. Okay? The housing crisis, the mortgage crisis, is not caused by people not paying their mortgages. It's caused by perceptions that the default rate in the securitized mortgages in the subprime market was actually higher than people had been led to believe, or that's what they said. Okay? As a result, they demanded higher interest payments, and the value of these things fell. These kind of securities are highly liquid. Fannie Mae, in particular, guarantees a bunch of these things, so they trade like treasury bonds. They're like this, almost, as they were widely accepted. But what happens if the value of the money in your pocket goes from $100 to $50? You feel poor. And in fact, a bunch of guys who were making deals using these kind of securitized market mortgages as the liquidity, that is the means of payment. You know, Boeing's got a couple hundred million sitting around today. It's going to need it next Tuesday. It parks it in one of these for 5 days. All of a sudden now found that either had to eat a 50% loss, but that's these numbers. It wasn't that big in this market. Or they had to lose their liquidity. They had to sit on their asset and wait for the mortgage payments to be made. And that loss of liquidity was caused not by people not making their payments, but by the decline in the value of these assets. So it spread into other parts of the financial system, not just the mortgage market.
Okay. I have a question before you go on, though, because you made a comment that was kind of surprising to me.
Huh?
You said that there was no way of knowing what was inside the bundles.
Not in the impersonal secondary market. Fannie Mae knows what's in the bundles.
That's not how I understood it, but I'm not an economist. What I understood was that when a bundle goes out, it's rated a AA.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the investors who looked at that bundle said it's rated AA, but what was being bundled in there were the lower rated ones.
Well, that means,
so that when there was a failure within that bundle, it was no longer it was failing at a higher rate than what the investors believed it was, and so that some of these companies are actually being looked at for fraud because they were bundling wrong. Is that right?
Let me jump.
Okay. Now we're going to go to the business.
Now we're going to go to the business.
Okay.
We had all these mortgages, subprime mortgages. Doesn't mean it's bad. But a lot of the subprime mortgages were people with blemished credit and conventionally could not get a prime mortgage. That's why they got a subprime mortgage. And the risk premium on that is higher than a prime mortgage. Okay. So the money that you can make on such a mortgage is a bigger spread than a prime mortgage. Okay. And what happened, I think, and where we're going to go to, is that these sort of secondary derivatives is you had the bundling of these subprime mortgages into what was called CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations. Okay, and there were further permutations of CMOs into CDOs, which is collateralized debt obligations, where folks on Wall Street would blend subprime mortgages with car loans, credit card loans, so a blended. And what was interesting is that the best and brightest, we call them quants, the quantitative analysts, and these are people from MIT with PhDs in physics that are engineering these things. And they are able to construct these securities, which are basically bonds, just in a different form, these CDOs, whereby the rating agencies look at them, and actually the rating agencies, I'm very critical of them, the rating agencies themselves don't really understand
the underlying risks of that bundle. And the quants are able to do this and convince and the rating agencies to give AAA rating to something. Now, a AAA rating gives you a nice warm security blanket. Okay, you're going to invest, you're going to buy this bond, you got a AAA rating. You also got, because of the risk premium, you're getting a heavier return because it's based largely on the subprime where the spreads are bigger. Okay. So what you have here is you have a low-risk instrument with a high return. Now, in Finance 101, right?
It's a good thing, but it's mathematically, it's not supposed to be possible.
Well, it's an attractive thing. It's an attractive thing.
Remember that in these markets, there's a trade-off between risk and return.
Right.
Right? And so what's happening is you're taking, in one financial asset, a bunch of different packages of risk. Mm-hmm. So you've got car loans and house loans and credit card debt. They all have different underlying risk patterns. So the quants are guys who are matching up these pieces to say, even though all the pieces are individually risky, because we put them all in one place, they're going to cancel each other out. So it's not quite as simple as saying
Okay.
It's mathematically impossible because you're talking about these hybrids of lots of different kinds of things.
And it is arguably that, you know, this level of sophistication of this and the globalization of these markets got so far ahead that the regulators didn't really understand them and the rating agencies didn't understand them. And I brought a quote in from a chap called Binder, who was former vice chairman of the Fed, and this is one of the best minds going, doctorate in economics from MIT, and they said he had only a modest understanding of complex derivatives. There are simple derivatives. These tend to be increasingly complex. And if you presented me with one and asked me to put a value on it, I'd be guessing. Okay, this is the vice chairman of the Fed. So what This was a good thing in a sense that a lot of people were getting mortgages, and we can go back to that a hefty percentage of these. There was a lot of winking going on, both from the countrywides of this world and from the borrowers who weren't maybe employed and didn't have, and they're saying, yeah, I'm employed, I'm making this, and there were a lot of irregularities.
Right.
And this goes back to the Fed earlier, right after 9/11 and the Enron issues and all that massive liquidity in the market, that there was all this cash around. And people are always chasing higher returns. So if you're chasing a higher return, you get a higher return with a subprime mortgage than you do with a prime mortgage. And so you with this bundling, you got these collateralized, these CMOs, you got these CDOs, and you got what's called a structural investment vehicle done by Citibank. And what happens this, and I'm going to try and keep this on a level, is that where there is a market for something, there is value. And where there isn't a market for something, there isn't value. And I mean, the subprime is not a painful thing, but it's very manageable in the system, in our economy. What created issues in the financial world was all the layered derivatives that came off of that. Okay, and that to me, again, I'm not being heartless, because that's the greater shake to the global financial system, and the shake is not the subprime. And what happens is that all major houses, Merrill and everyone, started, you know, this was a profitable business. You're selling something AAA rated, okay, and high return. People were buying this as much as they could. I mean, who wouldn't? Incredibly rational. Okay.
China invested in a bunch of it.
China invested in it. Then you say, well, if this is so good, I'm going to borrow money so I can invest in this. So they're leveraged up the wazoo to do this. And then when these things go bad, you not only are out what you put in, you're exponentially out.
Right.
So that must mean it's very much like the housing market itself. These bundles, for a time, were vastly overvalued. And then when the problems came, I suppose they're now undervalued?
I think the issue is that today it's difficult to value.
Right. They don't know what the value is.
They don't, and the problem when you have a publicly traded firm, like Merrill, like Citi, you're under accounting obligation, under protocol, where you cannot establish a value for your assets. You have to write it down.
So Merrill, zero.
Merrill had to write it down, Citi had to write it down, UBS has to write it down.
Remember, you don't really want to use the terms over and undervalued here, because it's about what's the price of this income stream.
Okay,
and it's not to say, oh, this is overvalued and this is undervalued. These are both the same value for something. The income stream didn't change.
Right.
But the interest rate and people's expectations about it did. Okay, that's where is there a market for it? And so this determines the value of the asset in the market, and that's what its value is. And if there's no market for it, its value is
zero. I don't want to get out of value and rating, because these were AAA rated.
Right.
And it really sounds like maybe only AA rated. Or, you know, the rating, there's a problem with how they rated them.
Yes. but the thing to remember here is that all these pieces that are bundled together, there is underlying, the problem is establishing a value. Okay. The problem isn't that there's no value, okay? And that underlying all these bundlings, okay, are mortgages, okay, are car loans, are other loans that are operating. Okay. The problem is the valuation. So at the end of the day, when this thing unwinds, the knock on the financial system is going to be manageable. Okay. There's two points there I want to make. One is 10 years ago, a company in Greenwich, Connecticut, for long-term capital management. Okay. Anybody remember that thing?
Yeah.
Where brilliant hedge fund, okay, and they leveraged $250 million dollars into billions, okay? And they bet, I won't go into it, but they made a huge bet, and it was flat wrong, okay? And because it was because it was so far leveraged, and it was interconnected with so many other things, it really, if they had gone down, when that thing had, you know, it would have brought down some other financial houses. So at that time, Wall Street firms and the Fed came in, and bought the assets of long-term capital management. Everybody said, "Oh my God, the government's coming in, the taxpayers are you know, bailing out these running dog capitalists." You know, of which two were Nobels, by the way. This is best and brightest.
They were economists.
At the end of the day, though, after this thing had been, you know, broken apart and unwound, the U.S. government actually made money on the deal. So the thing that, well, the Fed is going in to salvage Bear, okay, and critically was, you know, the bonds of Bear. Underlying all these things, these CMOs, these CDOs, and these SIVs are real income streams, are real, there's real value there, and the problem is in the financial system is when companies have to write, because they're having difficulty establishing that value. Okay, and the reason they're having difficulty establishing that value is because there's no market for those CDOs, because those right now are quote toxic. Okay, that people are in trouble. They're not going to put those things on their balance sheets, and so many financial companies around the world have this junk. Right now, it's junk. It's perceived as junk because you can't unload it. Okay, on the balance sheet. So the broader issue is that when major financial firms have these write-downs, okay, and they're losing capital, and then the amount of funds and capital that they have available to make loans to consumers and industry is much reduced. Okay, and they're right now talking to folks in New York, the system has seized up. And that is the greater concern and greater issue with the world economy. The U.S. economy is part of that, but it's the world economy. And it's important to, this is really important, but the subprime itself is a manageable.
Let me try to say what Kit just said. It's like if you did bring. Slightly different terms, because he used the term derivative, right? And the CDO, CMO, SIV kind of stuff. If you think about a bank making a loan to you and not ever selling the loan to a second person, right? There's still this structure of the value, the relationship to the value to the income stream. Okay? So this income stream is there, and right now it's really important to realize that people are paying their mortgages. This is, the crisis is not caused by people not making their payments. That, there's a little bit of that going on, but that's not the major deal. So there are these values over here, and let's say you're a bank, and you want to insure yourself against fluctuation in these values, right? So you sell another asset, which is tied to the value of the mortgages. That's a derivative, okay? I could buy a bet on the they don't sell individual mortgages on the market, they sell bundles. I can buy a bet on the price of this bundle. I can bet it's going to go down or it's going to go up. I can do a put or a call on this in the market. So as you get derivatives of derivatives, okay, and that's what you know these guys Fisher Black and people who won the Nobel Prize and then started long-term hedge fund. Saying, how can we, if we can insure banks against these kind of fluctuations by selling some of that risk in another market, right? Then we can make this market work better. But now this market is less connected to this income stream, right? So it's going to be more variable. When people start worrying about this, that's going to change these values, it's going to change this one. And of course, it's like the tail of the, you know, that's like the cracking the whip. The fluctuations are going to be bigger over here because you've got more leverage and that sort of thing. But as Kit said, and this is really important, everything in the end is based on these income streams. And if this stuff all gets paid off, everything's okay. But in the meantime, you can lose a couple $100 million betting on things over here. Right? Because these are 30-year mortgages and you might be in this market for a day. And that's why this sophistication causes all these problems.
So are you two in consensus about who are going to be the winners and who are going to be the losers when this thing works out?
Well, Warren Buffett's probably buying this thing now.
Yeah.
He didn't buy him 2 years ago. Are we in consensus? We figured that out.
I think we figured.
We figured mutual funds.
Yeah, we invest in mutual funds.
So. Good.
So,
which ones?
As these things have gotten so complex and only the MITs can understand them and there are all these layers and layers and layers, sounds like, can we trust the integrity of these few people that understand what in the heck is going on? I mean, is it a matter of trusting and not trusting that's really?
It's a very good question, but the we can go to another level. These are not just the evil people. Who's benefiting from, you know? Major buyer of these CDOs is pension funds. I mean, so, you know, and they're making money, they were making money, and they ultimately will make money on the underlying fund.
As long as they sit on the money and just wait for
And if you're trading if you're trading in and out, you're gonna take a bet.
Right.
Okay. There's a further piece that I think is kind of interesting. It's called, and you don't see it much, it's called a credit default swap.
A what?
The credit default swap.
We want to make things more complicated.
We want to make these complicated. This isn't okay. We did this simple.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Business school people would do that.
But a credit, this was promoted by Greenspan. I mean, so credit default swaps are like insurance, which you have the covers of the losses to banks or bondholders when the companies that are issuing those bonds fail to pay. So this is all right. Everybody got that?
What you're doing is you're selling. If there's a loss, right? You're buying. somebody else's, you're paying them to assume the loss.
It's stock,
and the
stock
rating of the bundles.
It's like, stock life insurance.
It is.
It is, but it's for bonds.
Okay. And those bonds were rated at
whatever they're rated at.
Well, don't I remember that some of those insurance companies had a rating?
Sure.
And if they had a AAA rating and they owned the risk, then that bond was elevated to a AAA rating because the insurance company had that rating. And then as some of those insurance companies started to have troubles, then the underlying values of the bonds started to suffer because they were actually A and AA rated things insured by AAA folks. Is that right?
Don't place too much weight on the ratings.
Okay.
Because if you're buying this stuff only on the basis of the rating, you should lose money. I mean, you should make money because that's all publicly available information. Right? So the ratings are there to provide information. They do provide information, but it's not misrating that's causing the problem. These things are risky. You know, what's the probability of you making money when you go to Vegas? Well, I give you a rating. It's less than zero, right? But that doesn't mean you won't go and make money or not make money.
How can we fix this without the lower income people getting screwed?
Can we get come back to that question? Because I want to come back to her question.
I want to do this other little piece on credit default swaps, which are, again, insurance against defaulting on a bond, and that is used legitimately as a hedge. So if you're a bank and you hold bonds or something else, you can hedge against that. And that insurance isn't a public, you know, there's no government in there. That's really unregulated. Okay. And the piece of that is that that has just, well, I do see a problem in that has just ballooned hugely. And in 2001, there was only $900 million of such credit default swaps. It's now at a $45 trillion level. It's 12 zeros. And it's hugely into speculation on the hedge speculation side. So Devoid is not just a hedge for those that hold the bonds. It's also used as making a bet, as John says, on the soundness of a bond, okay? And if you're holding Bear Stearns bonds and you've got insurance on those bonds and those bonds are losing value because everybody thinks Bear Stearns is going down, it's going to default, the value of that insurance is going to go up, and you can make a ton of money. Okay. The interesting thing is just back to the question on who's the losers, interestingly, okay, when Bank of America took over Countrywide had bonds of a lot of insurance against their bonds, and Bear Stearns had a lot of insurance against their bonds, like $2.5 trillion. Okay. When they were taken over by J.P. Morgan, okay, and Countrywide was taken over by Bank of America, and so they subsumed the obligations of those companies. The holders of these default swaps that were betting against, okay, that saying these companies are going to go down and were showing great paper gain, okay, they took a wacky doodle hit, okay, and oftentimes they would buy, you know, they'd buy the stuff and they'd leverage to buy the insurance. So now not only are they out premium, they're leveraged on this. So the losers on this time around is actually the gods of the universe, you know, running hedge funds. And nobody's exactly volunteering saying,
I lost a lot of money
this month, you know?
Yeah, that's what I lost a lot of money. That's what, it's really important to understand that most of the monitoring of this is by the guys that are playing in the game for whom the ratings are transparent, because the people who own stock in Bear Stearns lost how many billions? The stock went from what, 179 to 2?
179 to 2.
And those, you know, some of those people were the old ladies in Des Moines, but the big players were the partners in Bear Stearns. And they know they're playing a risky game, and they're paying lots of attention to each other. Okay? And so most of the time, this is regulated within the market. It doesn't mean it always is, and there are certain things that there's reasonable to have regulation for it, and, you know, so that everybody's telling the truth. That's a really nice thing to do. But otherwise, a lot of the, like,
because they don't want to lose. You know, and these guys are talking about, you know, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars if this price goes up and down 1%. So they're really paying attention. They're really monitoring. And they're moving money in and out. And that, you know, they're in some sense, this is, well, in large part, self-regulating. And it, you know what? It usually really works.
It sounds like it should.
It does.
If you're invested in your own, it's a positive.
And so what happens, so this is why we go back to this really simple example. When everybody loses confidence, this, and liquidity dries up, then the whole, it's like having a car with the oil going up. The motor's not wrong. It's the, there's no oil. Okay, so there was up there.
I've heard many.
Can we return to his question? Because I sort of shut him off. And I didn't mean to, but I wanted to make sure we carried on this point.
Right, what do we do with this?
Yeah, you heard my question.
Yeah, I did. And it's a really good question. Are poor people worse off or better off because of this?
Some of that's unclear, because a lot of these.
Why do you think they're worse off?
Because the mortgage market has dried up, and I think that they've been scandalized by the subprime high rates. They can't qualify. They can't pay these loans that they've been made, so it ruins their credit rating. They're going to get foreclosed now. They've been set up for failure.
Okay. Is this about?
Part of the question here has to do not just this scenario is built on fixed value or fixed interest rate. This income stream is guaranteed for a long period of time because we loan at a certain rate.
No, this is the income stream.
Right. Yeah. But so I, as a guy making a mortgage payment, I borrow at X percent, that fixes my mortgage rate for a period of time, and I'm going to pay my X number of dollars a month. But if the interest rate changes,
the adjustable rate.
With the adjustable rate mortgages, then.
That's a math problem.
My payment goes up,
right?
So is
or it goes down,
possibly. This is my.
It can go down.
But I get that. But I think part of the question now is, what happens with people who borrowed, the low income people who got non-conforming ARMs, and now they don't know if they're going to be able to make their payments in the future because they don't get the rates are going up or down.
So let's think about that. And there's two parts to this that are really important to keep in mind. If and the subprime part gets a little bit tricky here, as this system goes into place and interest rates come down and the risk sharing of Fannie Mae gets better and better, what happens to the ability of poorer and poorer people to get into a home? It increases. Okay? I mean, it really does, because they can borrow at lower rates. This market is more stable, okay? So home ownership rates in the United States are higher than any other country in the world by a good bit for most places. And that's a really good thing, okay? So what happened here with the subprime, and these are the horror stories we've been hearing, is that people were, as loans that have lower and lower standards, is that the less equity or less ratio of income to payments, greater ratio of payments to income you want to be. So that people who were riskier and riskier were being included in this. Some of those people have found themselves now unable to make their payments. And they've lost something, because as you know, if you buy a house, you put this big upfront payment in, which is at risk, right? So some of those people are worse off. Now, on net, if you lose your home, you are worse off, right? So, on balance, are the people who are able to get access to loans better off or worse off?
Yeah,
it's really complicated.
As a group, they may be better off, but individual people may be.
Yeah, well, you buy life insurance. Are you better off if you collapse?
Your wife might be.
You don't want to take one cause and then say there's all kinds of complications and put that onto this, right?
Right, but it factors into whether poor people are better off.
It does, but then you still have to do this whole picture thing.
Because you're saying the economy is better off because more people can afford housing. But isn't it a failure of our regulation that the subprime market, the default rate's so high? And
no. I don't know. How many of you ever borrowed money when you were a college student? You were a terrible risk. What did you pay?
A lot.
A lot.
18-25%.
Right? Was that wrong?
I don't know.
Okay. You know, are you better off buying a going to Bank of America and getting a housing a loan for 8% and a low rate, or going to a loan shark and getting a 25%? Okay. Or not being able to have a house. You know, how we weigh those things is really, 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 really tough. I mean, I'm not saying I have an answer and that the answer is, well, this is positive and good. I'm saying that we really want to, there's two parts to this.
But isn't fraud basically a different question?
But this is not fraud.
No, I know. I'm not saying it is, but I think that's what's kind of the...
But that's what, one of the things that can, now I'm talking too much, aren't I? I should shut up.
You're doing great.
Value versus the perception of value. It's really important to understand, despite what you hear in talking heads, when you turn on the television, this is not being caused largely because of people who made fraudulent claims to people who were low income, who got into loans and then discovered that they couldn't pay. Okay? There are cases of that. It happens to my colleagues who make over $100,000 a year who don't read all the fine print. My wife is surprised when our variable rate mortgage went up. I said, don't you remember I told you? Okay, so this event is not being caused by that. But there's plenty of people on television telling you that that's the problem, okay? And yes, fraud is a problem, but it's not. That's not what this problem is about, okay?
Can I just mention, when we're thinking about the folks that are defaulting on their mortgages and the foreclosure problem that we're facing, I work in the housing finance field in Twin Cities in Minnesota. And one of the things that's really easy to make the assumption of is to think, well, you know, all these foreclosures are in the north side of Minneapolis where
right.
poor people are. There's a lot of population in the north side of Minneapolis, so there's a lot of foreclosures there. But 2 years ago, and I realize it's an old statistic, but 2 years ago, the greatest ratio of where the most foreclosures were in the Twin Cities was on Marina on St. Croix, which is a very wealthy, exclusive city on the river outside of the Twin Cities. And so I think it's very dangerous to make an assumption that, you know, the folks that are having the foreclosures are only poor people. That there are, it really is truly in every single zip code, in every single region.
For me, people aren't reading the fine print. You know, they're buying a variable or getting a variable rate mortgage, and they're thinking, well, they're going for as much as they can borrow at this low rate without any safety net. You know, they're not setting any safety net for themselves. So when the rate goes up a little bit, they're out. They made a bad bet.
Sure, or they lost their job, or they didn't get the promotion of the raise that they figured was going to cover the adjustment.
Right, but
yet it was sort of a gamble. I'm not looking to bail those folks out at this point because I'm one of them. So.
But all those things were true before there were any subprime mortgages. And all those things were true before there was Fannie Mae, right? I mean, those are real things that do affect. It goes on that we can't get away from.
How is all this with the derivatives cause problems in the wider credit availability in the wider credit market?
That's the liquidity problem.
That's the piece I walked through is that when there is this perception, when people cannot, because of this perception that it's very difficult to value a CMO or CDO, then the liquidity, then you have to write that down if you cannot value that derivative, okay, that structured paper. And if you are if you're a publicly traded company and you cannot value the assets underneath there, you have to write it down. And so you write down your capital base, it really limits, you know, you're taking a big whack, it really limits your ability to then make loans to consumers and to business. And that's and that's a global issue now, that's seized up. And that's, to me, the greater, we'll get through this, but that's the greater crunch now that's facing business. And additionally, despite, you know, what's happening on Wall Street, whatever, you know, the underlying strength of this economy are phenomenal. And, you know, relative to much of the world, we're doing, I'm not Pollyanna here, we're doing fairly well.
Yeah. Wait, there was a question up here, and then we'll come back down here.
I heard an author, and I can't remember his name or the book, but it was just about this whole thing, not recently released, and he was talking about how they were like in hotel ballrooms, almost like boiler, you know, rooms of people on the phone approving, like, you know, 1 an hour of mortgages where, you know, your the ability to repay or and even some, you know, and the valuation of property both become not real verifiable. So I guess part of my question is there going to be a whole process where these subprime bundles are going to be opened up and looked at and then revalued? And then will there be a value that can be set on that?
Ultimately, a value will be set on where these things. I mean, they're on the books. That will be set.
The mortgages are there. They're going to be repaid, and somebody's holding this stuff right now.
So, but the main thing is that there's been a loss of confidence as to what the value is with them.
Right.
And is it mainly driven by the subprime? Then it's not, as opposed to, I mean, I know Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were also somewhat affected because of the loss of confidence rippled. Right?
Everybody, what happened? So. This is why I really want you to come back here, okay?
When this interest rate changes,
let's say the interest rates are really closely connected because investors can put their money in stocks, bonds, loans, all kinds of things. So the interest rates for everything all move together. So if there's a loss of confidence in one thing, it's going to result in rising interest rates in every financial market, and that's going to result in a reduction in the value of assets in every financial market. So we call this the subprime crisis because that was where it started. 6 years ago, we called it the high-tech boom because that's where it started. In 1987, it kind of came out of the blue. It used to be caused by crop failures in the Midwest. In 1931, there was a bunch of Kentucky banks because the wheat crop was bad, the Dust Bowl was coming. So there's a bunch of things that can be the starter, but the crisis of confidence occurs because these markets are all connected. And when these interest rates change, these values come down, and then you become less liquid. That's what we're going through, you know. And the derivatives make it happen faster because everything gets more closely connected. Yeah.
I have two questions. One is, several years ago, Warren Buffett, I believe it was, said that derivatives were financial equivalent of financial weapons of mass destruction.
Potential weapons of mass destruction.
Okay. Right. So that's one question. And the question around that is, did anybody listen at that time? Were there changes made at that time? Second question is, is it a false assumption to think that everybody should be able to own a home? Some people, either financially, you know, are never going to be able to own one or make the payments. And some people don't have the aptitude to take care of a home, to own a home. So are we as a society making a false assumption that?
I think it's to the second one, I think it's hard, but I think it's fair to say that there are people who should not, you know, are unable to carry a mortgage of a certain amount. And there was so much liquidity in the United States that was pushing, had to find places for money to go, and really that's an issue. The Fed, the regulators should have been watching. The SEC should have been doing more. And to an earlier point, I don't really know, and I don't really believe that the regulators understood the level of sophistication on some of these structured vehicles. As I was telling Don before, a year and two ago, I had students, undergraduate students, who were making good money selling mortgages. Okay, and there's not all undergraduate students are brilliant, and that's the nose of the camel under the tent or something. I think a regulatory issue could be that these again, you know, I'm a business guy and all that, but if the Countrywides of this world, in selling these mortgages, had to hold in their portfolio a chunk, and we can argue about what that chunk should be, so they should have some skin in the game on the downside of this. Additionally, the investment houses, you know, this is being actually talked within the investment community, not just on a regulatory point of view, that they would hold a piece of these structured vehicles at least for a period of time. So there's not this. I think there was a problem where you can, and it's all legal and everything. You can write a mortgage and you sell it to somebody else. If it's not that good a mortgage, you're playing hot potato. It's yours. Okay, I made my fee. We're done. So I think on that level, sort of small bore fixes or small bore regulations or rules, whether they're regulatory or sort of within the industry, I think we'll be seeing that. But it would be wrong for Congress, as John says, to blame us on the subprime and start big take out the howitzer and blow something up, because we have, you know, I talked about long-term capital. John talked about four or five other times where, you know,
it's got to wait. You know, the problem. So the savings and loan crisis, the Resolution Trust Corporation had to buy something like, I don't know, how many trillions of dollars of savings and loan assets that were almost all mortgages. And the savings and loans were going bankrupt in real time. And we had the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. So as the savings and loans went out of business, their mortgages were transferred to the Resolution Trust Corporation that both sold property and just held onto the mortgage till they got paid off. And in the end, it was something like $180 billion or something. It was a tiny multiple, a small fraction of the original cost, because it was the waiting part that you needed to do. But that's the illiquidity part, right? If you invest, you know, when you invest in a college education, you don't get it all back tomorrow, right? You got to live to get it back. And these are markets for allowing people to make better long-term investments in things, not just houses. Well, their self-productive equipment and all that kind of thing. And that means that this liquidity thing becomes more important. And so I could list them, but I love going through the list. That just shows I can remember the dates. You know, when I can't remember the dates, of all the times this has happened in the past, and they're always, you know, they happen in different ways, but it's part and parcel of being more productive.
So when will this episode be history, Mr. Historian?
I'm a historian. You know, I invest in mutual funds because I know that I don't know enough to do this. I've lost my money. You know, I've doubled my money in 2000 to 2001 and lost it all the next year in tech.
Yeah.
And every time I think I'm smart, I go. It's not me who does it. It's the world. If you reach up, smash me upside the head. I'm glad that I live in a world with these kind of instruments, because in fact I can invest more, I gotta have a bigger pension, I'm gonna live better, it's easier for me to buy my house. You know? But the cost of it is, you know, some uncertainty. Now, you know, these guys in Jubilee, you know, aren't planting crops every 7 years, they didn't have insurance against drought. Right? They didn't have insurance against a tornado, locusts, any of the things that happen in the Bible virtually every third page. Right? And they were really worse off, because in our world that stuff happens and it goes like this. It doesn't go psh, psh, because we have all these kinds of ways of sharing risk and spreading things around.
And the water keeps running and the electricity goes. Yeah. Wow.
Well, but John and Kit, I'm still having a little trouble what you're saying, because I know there were many mortgages, I don't know what percentage of the total it was, but there were many mortgages made to people where they actually got 100%, they got a loan on 100% of the house,
correct.
And their resources were not fully checked. And it would make me, frankly, very angry if this practice continues. I mean, is our industry, is the Congress, or the industry itself going to make some beneficial changes that will prevent that in the future?
Hope so.
Yes, the answer is
yes.
Yeah, one of the things, I mean, we tend to think, I mean, from the outside, we tend to think a lot of this is like these small, shady loan makers,
right.
You know,
yeah,
in
shady.
These, what you call it, boiler room kind of
right.
thing. Well, remember that most of the demand for these packaged AAA rated loans was coming from the international investment markets, who wanted to then loan that money out as for tractors in China or for whatever that builds the whole economy. And so it was really like the Wall Street demand coming downstream to get people into these rooms, making these loans for, as you say, zero down, no questions asked. You say you make $100,000 a year, fine, here's sign, go.
Right.
Okay. So I mean, it was greed everywhere. And the only regulation is those people who were making those boiler rooms loans are now out of business anyway.
Because there's no one to sell those loans.
That's right.
Yes, the coordinators, we already, we have.
Andy May.
This we're bailing out, though.
Right. Oh, no, look, we're bailing them out, not because they made bad loans. We're bailing them out because of this problem.
Right. We're doing
it. Okay. Fannie Mae, its market value is going down, and it is providing liquidity to this market. We don't want, we're in the liquidity crisis. Fannie Mae's job is to make it easier to buy and sell mortgages. We don't want to make it harder to buy and sell mortgages.
But isn't it Freddie and Credit, they didn't reserve? They didn't hold a reserve?
No, but they have assets. Interest rates have gone up. What's happened to the value of those assets?
Yeah.
It's gone down. And so now what were reserves, right, have become less in value because of the interest rate change, not because they didn't keep enough money out. This is why it's really, when you look at the words, it seems like, oh, they don't have the reserves. They didn't save enough money. They're, you know, but in fact, they're being affected by this common problem, and that's the liquidity problem. And that's why we're really out of time. That's why the Federal Reserve Board was created. Thank you very much.